Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Queen on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest this week will be Erica Goodman. She is the New York Regional Director at the American Farmland Trust, and she'll be coming on in just a little bit, and we'll tell you more about her and the work she's doing with the American Farmland Trust in just a bit. But first, I want to share with you some ways to take action, some things in the news, and of course, share this week's recipe with you. Starting with in the news, and I'm sure we'll be talking more about this with Erica when she comes on, is the new applications for farm-to-school grants are open. And New York State has their own farm-to-school grant program, as well as the USDA funds the farm-to-school grant programs. And applications are open to that. And the farm-to-school program is just brilliant and necessary, and we should need a lot more of them because it actually connects kids to where their food comes from. And so many kids still think food comes from a supermarket. They have no clue where food really comes from. You know, I remember hearing about touring the country with potatoes and kids thinking they're rocks. I mean, kids eat more French fries than you could imagine, but they have no idea what a potato looks like. So farm to school programs really encourage kids to get their hands dirty. It encourages better eating. Many studies have shown that when kids grow it, they're more likely to eat it. It is just so much better all around. And it brings fresh vegetables into the school lunch program, which is really, really important. So those applications are open. So if you're in a school and you are interested in bringing more fresh vegetables or gardens into your school program, you know, go onto my website and you'll find links to check that out. And so really, really worth it to do that. Also, I wrote about this week how greenhouse gas emissions had reached record levels in 2020, even though travel was down, driving was down, people were really kind of locked down with the pandemic. And so the hope was that we really would see a dip in the greenhouse gas emissions, and that did not really happen. You know, years ago, I think it was 13 years ago, 350.org was founded. I was a member of back when they first started. 350.org is an organization that was based on 350 parts per million of how much CO2 can be in the planet and us still be safe and be able to share the planet. However, we are now at 413 parts per million, way beyond the safe limit, and we really need to really check that in and turn it around. And President Biden has been really working hard to try to get this $3.2 trillion bill passed, the Build Back Better plan, which really will address climate change as well as so many other issues in our country, infrastructure, inequality, so many issues. And it's really having a hard time. I mean, you know, there's a few conservative Democratic legislators that are just not willing to put it through. And they are weakening what he has been asking for. I think it's now down to $2 trillion bill. They've cut a lot of the environmental issues out, unfortunately. But, you know, he's already on his way to the climate change conference in Glasgow. And he needs to be able to go to the table and show that America is serious about pulling in the reins with our emissions, because we are the biggest polluters on the planet. And individually, we all need to do what we can, whether it's put up solar panels, whether it's look at our diet and start eating you know, less meat, which adds to so much greenhouse gas emissions. Where we source from. There's a lot we can do on an individual level, but the majority, in order to really see change, has to happen on a legislative level. And the Build Back Better plan really is addressing some of that. But he cannot show up in Glasgow and sit at that table in front of all the other countries and really make them feel like we're serious if we don't have a bill that shows we're serious. And so, you know, let your legislators know how important you feel this is and really get involved, because our planet is at such risk of demise, and we need to really step up to the plate and do something about it. I also wrote about arsenic in rice and in children's cereal. You know, years ago, I found out about arsenic in rice. And, you know, some of the arsenic comes from the pollutants we've been putting on the land, the pesticides. But rice in general is a grain that absorbs more arsenic than other grains. And it is a real problem because there's high levels of arsenic in our rice, especially, unfortunately, in brown rice, which is a whole grain rice. Because it keeps the whole grain together, it has more of the arsenic in it. So the article I was reading said the rice with the least amount of arsenic is balsamic rice. Basmati rice from California has the least amount. But there are ways to reduce arsenic in the rice. And I've been telling people this for so many years. Traditionally, we always cooked our rice, one cup of rice to two cups of water. Now the recommendation is to really take that one cup of rice, run it under water. You can even soak it for a while, but then run it under water and really scrub it underneath the running water to wash off like 50% of the arsenic. And then boil the rice in a big pot of water, the same way you cook pasta in a big pot of water. That's how you want to cook your rice now, in a big pot of water. And then when it's finished, and you can, you know, do taste testing to see when it's finished, or you can, you know, use the usual amount of time, and then drain it. Drain it into your sink and let it just drain out for a while. And it's delicious. It comes out just as good. The one thing that you can't do, which I know a lot of people like to do, is cook the rice in broth. You're not going to waste a whole pot of beautiful vegetable broth and then drain it out. So you are going to need to season the rice afterwards, because you're not going to be cooking the rice in vegetable broth and then just dumping it down the sink, or chicken broth, or whatever your thing is. But that will remove a lot of the arsenic. But meanwhile, the arsenic is showing up in children's food, especially in children's cereal and infant cereal. And as you can imagine, children are much more susceptible to arsenic poisoning than adults, just because their bodies look smaller and they can deal with less of it. And so Beechnut, back in June, did a recall of all of their cereal because they were way beyond the limits of safe arsenic levels. And it doesn't take a lot. I mean, I was surprised to find out one serving of rice cereal or one rice cake could put kids over the maximum level of what's considered safe for a weekly limit. So it's not a lot, or it doesn't take a lot to put you over that limit. So it's really a problem. So we need to get this arsenic out of the rice, you know, whether they put the rice through a cleansing process to remove the arsenic before they make the cereal, or else parents just stop buying infant rice cereal for your kids. It's really a problem. And when you're cooking rice, and rice is so healthy and it is a staple in so many people's diets around the world, and I know I eat quite a bit of rice, that you really need to take that extra step to remove the arsenic from the rice first. And now I want to share with you my recipe before I introduce Erica to all of you. This week I made my vegan moussaka again, and it's just so good. And I know I've shared this once before on my radio show, but I'm pulling it up again because I've harvested the last of my eggplant and I just dug up all my potatoes yesterday. So it's really, you know, a seasonal dish, and it's really so perfect. And moussaka is one of those dishes that I, you know, that just always looks so good at the restaurant, but I never could have because it's made with lamb. And this dish is really, really great. So I'm first going to go through the ingredients with you and then show you how to put it all together. There's a couple different steps because you're going to make First, we're going to roast the eggplant and the potatoes. We're going to make the tempeh mixture, which is what's replacing the lamb mixture. We're going to make a cashew sauce, which is going to replace the bechamel sauce, and then just a little breadcrumb topping. So you're going to start, the ingredients are 1 to 2 eggplants, depending on the size and depending on how big a casserole you want to make. 4 to 6 large potatoes that you're going to slice into thin rounds. 1/2 cup of extra virgin olive oil and some kosher salt. For the tempeh sauce, you're going to have 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 1 medium yellow onion, 3 cloves of garlic, 1 8-ounce package of tempeh. You can use a soy tempeh or you can use a tempeh that has other grains in it. This recipe can easily be made gluten-free. If you use gluten-free breadcrumbs on the top and your tempeh is gluten-free. So keep that in mind depending on who you're making this for. 2 portobello mushrooms, finely chopped. 2 assorted peppers, also chopped or diced. 1 teaspoon dried oregano. 1/4 teaspoon ground allspice. A pinch of ground cloves. 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon. 1/2 teaspoon of salt. Freshly ground pepper. 1 cup of fire roasted tomatoes. I actually just used 1 can of fire roasted tomatoes. 5 sun-dried tomatoes that you're going to pulse and puree. 1 tablespoon of tomato paste and 1 bay leaf. For the cashew sauce, 1.5 cups of cashews that you're going to soak for a couple hours. 1.5 cups of water. 1 teaspoon sea salt. 1/4 teaspoon of ground nutmeg. And 1 tablespoon of nutritional yeast. And for the breadcrumb topping, 1/2 cup of breadcrumbs, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon ground garlic, a little olive oil, and 1 tablespoon of chopped parsley. So you're going to start by baking the eggplant and the potatoes in the oven. So preheat your oven to a high temperature, about 475, works really well. You're cutting the eggplant and the potatoes relatively thin. The eggplant you're going to cut about quarter inch thick. And the potatoes can even be a little bit thinner than that. You're going to brush them with both sides with some of the olive oil. Lay it out on a large baking sheet that you line with parchment paper. And you're going to do that both for the eggplant and for the potatoes. And you're going to roast those in the oven until they're all cooked. Takes about 25 minutes or so for the eggplant and the potatoes. And I actually cover them when I'm roasting them. I cover them with a piece of parchment paper also so that they don't get crispy and they stay moist. While that's roasting, you can make the tempeh sauce. You heat the olive oil in a large skillet over medium heat. Add the onion and cook until they're lightly browned, about 5 minutes. Add the peppers and the garlic and continue cooking, stirring frequently for about another 3 minutes or so. Add the tempeh, the oregano, the allspice, the cloves, and the cinnamon. Cook that for about another 5 minutes. Add the portobello mushrooms, the fire-roasted tomatoes, the salt, and let that cook down for about 5 more minutes. Then push all those vegetables to the side. In the center of the pan, add the tomato paste, the sun-dried tomatoes, and the bay leaf, and mix that together, and then mix everything together, and cover it and let that simmer for about 15 minutes and let that sauce all come together and taste it. You know, everyone's taste is different, and also depending on how old your spices are will depend on how aromatic they are. So, you know, sometimes spices can hang around for a long time. So if you want, you can add a little extra cinnamon, a little extra allspice just to make it really aromatic, because that's the key to making this really taste like a Mediterranean moussaka. You're going to make the cashew sauce very easy. You're just going to drain those cashews that were soaking. And let me just tell you also a trick I've learned. If you don't have time to soak the cashews for a couple hours, pour boiling water in it and just let it soak for 15 minutes. And the boiling water just makes it puree or get soft that much quicker. And then drain it. And that really works fine too, especially if you have a high-powered Vitamix or a good Cuisinart. So you're going to drain the cashews, put the cashews into the food processor, pulse it until it's finely chopped, add the water the salt and the nutritional yeast and the nutmeg, and just let that go and pulse it at first, and then just whip it until it gets really, really creamy, kind of like the consistency of sour cream. You're going to toast the breadcrumbs in the bottom of a heavy skillet with a little bit of olive oil. Add the garlic and the salt and just let that brown for about 2 minutes. And then you can remove that from the stovetop too. And then you're just going to bring it all together, assemble it the same way you would with a lasagna. So you're going to start, you can sprinkle, spray the Pyrex casserole dish that you're using, or whatever casserole dish you're going to put this in. Spray the bottom with a little bit of olive oil. You can sprinkle a little bit of those breadcrumbs on the bottom, which also helps to keep the eggplant and the potatoes from sticking. And then you're going to layer. You're going to first put down a layer of the eggplant, and you can overlap the slices a little bit. Spread half of the tempeh sauce evenly over the eggplant. Repeat with the potatoes, then put the remaining tempeh sauce over. Pour the cashew bechamel sauce over the whole thing. Smooth it out with a rubber spatula. Sprinkle the breadcrumbs on top and bake it in the oven for about 45 minutes. And that's it. I know it sounds like a lot, but you can also do parts of this ahead of time, you know, if you want to pull it together. But it's a really great dish also if you're having company, because you can make it ahead of time and have it in the refrigerator and then stick it in the oven right when, you know, company's coming. And 45 minutes later, pull it out of the oven and you've not had to be in the kitchen while your guests are there. So it's really a wonderful dish, and I've gotten such great response from it. So I hope you all give it a try. And now it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Erica Goodman. As I said, she's the New York Regional Director at the American Farmland Trust. And American Farmland Trust is a nonprofit organization that stands at the intersection of agriculture and the environment, protecting farmland, promoting conservation easements, and supporting better farming practices. Erica oversees the organization's work in New York and neighboring New Jersey. She's a native New Yorker and grew up as part of a multi-generational dairy farm family in Washington County. Erica has previously held roles at American Farmland Trust's National Communications Team, served as Associate Director of Corporate Partnership at Food Corps, and since 2016, Erica has served as Representative at Large for urban, suburban, and rural non-farm interests on the New York State Soil and Water Conservation Committee. In addition, she was named one of Hunter College's 40 Under 40 in New York City food policy in 2018. And that's a real honor. So congratulations, Erica, on that. And Erica, welcome.
Thank you, Bhavani. It's lovely to meet you this morning and to have a recipe now for the eggplant and potatoes sitting in my fridge. So thank you, the moussaka is amazing.
Yeah, it's a real, it's a really great recipe. I remember I thought it up. I was like, I was away on vacation. I don't know how I, why I was thinking about moussaka, but I was, and I came back and had to make it. So, maybe you could just start by telling us your own personal story, like how you grew up in a dairy farm family. Did you know that you wanted to continue working on farm policy, or what was your path to get to where you are today?
I definitely came back to it. I'd say, you know, growing up on a dairy farm, you experience the farm on a day-to-day basis. And certainly the farm had been managed by our family for about 160 years. And my dad was also a school teacher, so kind of saw this value of connecting both to food and the land, as well as the role of education. And my career, both you mentioned working at Food Corps and then working in American Farmland Trust, has really been connected to those two pieces. And I should mention too, my generation was the last that decided not to farm there. And so I kind of really appreciate the opportunity at American Farmland Trust to think about the future of agriculture and the future of farmers and how those really come together to support a more resilient food system.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you mentioned your father was also a teacher. I know quite a few farmers, and they all have other jobs too. You know, it's hard to make a living as a farmer, and especially with your health insurance and all those things. So a lot of farmers I know have second jobs or first jobs, and then farming is their second job. Is that your experience as well? Have you seen that?
I would say so. And I think it depends certainly on the size and scale of the farm. And if it's not the farmer themselves, it's perhaps a spouse or another partner who has kind of a secondary income in a way. But certainly farming is a business of passion in many ways, as much as it is of other type of financial success.
Uh-huh. So now tell us a little bit about American Farmland Trust on, you know, the broad strokes of what you're working on. I mean, you focus mostly in New York, but maybe first tell us more about American Farmland Trust generally, and then we'll come back to New York.
American Farmland Trust was started about 40 years ago with an observation that there was no organization out there working both on the side of the environment as well as the side of farmers, and seeing that we were losing farmland across the country to development and other causes. And if we were not paying attention now and preserving some of that land, it would not be available in the future for food production, for the role that farmland plays in conservation and thinking about carbon and the future of climate. So there were some visionaries that came together and really set that pace for the organization 40 years ago around protecting farmland. And that's really been on supporting states and supporting federal policy around farmland protection, as well as communities and thinking about their own plans. And since then, the organization has evolved to think about not just the land, but also what are the practices on that land? How are farmers of all scale and all type of operation thinking about the soil and thinking about water quality connected to their farming practices and the more global impact that has on climate? And then also to ensure that there are people, that there are farmers that are transitioning from one generation to the next, that farm families are able to continue on, that new farmers who might not have grown up in the situation that I did have a place to farm and have a future there, and that there are kind of opportunities for those farmers to succeed in agriculture. So we're working at that across the country. We have 6 regional offices, as well as some national initiatives that we lead to really go deeper into all those areas and to both have kind of on the ground programs as well as influence at a wider policy level, both at the state and at the federal government. And so we're an organization of 130 plus now across the country, and really working in partnership in many ways in both those regions and at the national level, because we kind of see the opportunity for collaboration. And that was how the organization was started, is how do we bring communities of interest together to address some of our pressing issues.
Mm-hmm. And I think they've had to change quite a bit as they started too. I mean, when they started, it was more about easement and keeping land farming. And I think over the years, it's become more aware that it also has to focus on the good farming practices, because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at first they weren't so much about sustainability. And let me correct, I know our local farm bureau, you know, sustainability to the head of our farm bureau was just keeping the farm in business. It had nothing to do with the environment. So, you know, and I appreciate that, because we do need to keep farmers in business. But then at some point, it did also become aware that they need to protect the environment. When did that transition start happening?
I'm not sure I can pinpoint the exact year, but it certainly has been, you know, in the more recent decades of the organization, because I think you're right. Really, how do we start with the base of land? And that was the first step to preserving farms. But also there's a connection to farms that are not preserved, or even how do we extend and ensure that land remains viable into the future? And that is really where the practices come into play, is we need to think about protecting farmland. We also need to make sure that those practices are keeping soil healthy and water clean for communities. And so we, you know, have in recent decades really focused on that and really understanding as part of that broader holistic approach, because they just feed off of each other in such an important way when we're thinking about a resilient farm future and a resilient future for the country and the world more generally.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the biggest challenges that you think farmers are facing right now in New York?
There's certainly, you know, we think about climate. Governor Hochul had a state of emergency earlier this week for major flooding. And so that's something that impacts our municipalities and impacts our farmers. So farmers are really bearing the brunt when it comes at times to fluctuating climates. You know, in New York State, we're seeing a lot of heavy rains. In other parts of the country, we're seeing a lot of drought and a lot of wildfires. And so that certainly impacts farmers, but they're also really integral, as you were mentioning, and kind of thinking about where the direction of the organization has gone, they're integral in being part of the solution. And so I think that's one of the big challenges, but also a big opportunity that we're seeing for farmers. Certainly a generational transition in New York State, a third of the farmers are 65 or older, and 90% of them are not sure who's going to take over the farm once they retire. And those farmers are at or near retiring age as it is. So it's really important to both protect the land, have good practices on it, but we need to have farmers who are farming. And we also need to ensure that more diverse communities of farmers are able to access land and to build relationships with and access to land more broadly at the state level. And so those are two main things. I'd also say, you know, farmers are dealing with continued impacts of the pandemic. And we hear a lot right now about our disruptions in terms of the supply chain, and farmers are those who begin producing food. And so disruptions along the way certainly continue to impact them. So how are you thinking about supporting farmers more locally, and what are pathways to do that to connect farmers at the local level, which really supports their resilience for business and addresses some of those supply chain issues?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're aware of the whole debacle with Dannon and Horizon Milk, and you know, when you talk about food supply chain, our local farmers have really been impacted heavily by the announcement from Horizon Milk, which is owned by Dannon, that which is a French company, that they are going to cancel their contracts with all these Northeast farmers. I think there were 89 new Northeast farmers that were notified that they were no longer going to continue purchasing milk from them. What happens in a case like that? Is American Farmland Trust involved in that? Has that impacted your work trying to find a new supply chain for them, or a new, I don't know, is it still considered a supply chain when you're trying to find someone to buy the milk, as opposed to where does it come from? But, you know, they need to replace that. You know, they have all this milk that they make, and they're set up one way for bulk distribution. You know, all of a sudden, if they now have to package it small, they need to find a new place. How does that all work?
It really is complicated, as you're identifying, and it has a lot to do with relationships that are at the level of the farm and beyond. And, you know, New York is such a strong dairy state, and especially as someone who's grown up as part of the environment, it has often has a lot of extreme fluctuations. And so I think where, you know, AFT is not really intervening when it comes to those level of supply chain issues, we are working on programs that are supporting and helping farmers to kind of have a team of support services around them. So one of our programs in New York is called Farmland for a New Generation in New York. It's a partnership with the state of New York and the Department of Ag and Markets, along with 30 plus organizations across the state. And those individuals are thinking about land transition. And so when you're thinking about business transition, oftentimes that is a part of it too. And so when you see this big shift in who the purchasers are and some of the supply chain changes, how are we enabling and providing some of that support network at the level of the farm? And that's, you know, one of the big programs we have looking at land transition. So farmers coming in, farmers, you know, looking to exit, and oftentimes there's some sort of business chain in the mix of that. But we typically don't get involved kind of at that scale, but where are some of the things we're learning from that process that will inform policy, that will inform some of those on the ground programs and support services that are needed for farmers? How are we thinking about the partners that we're working with who are in the communities working with farmers as well to provide the support, and just making sure we're mindful of all of that as they're going through some large transition? But really, I think in any of this, it takes a team. And so how are we both providing the right support to those teams that will then support the farmers? And that comes at both the programmatic level as well as at the policy level.
Mm-hmm. I know as a someone who lives on Long Island, and I was the farm to school coordinator at a local public school prior to COVID. And one of our issues, you know, New York has that incentive to get, try to purchase 30% New York product in order to get extra payback on your extra credit on your school costs or your lunch costs. And we couldn't actually meet our quota because we didn't have access to New York State milk. Mm-hmm. And that is the main thing that would have gotten us over that hurdle. And starting this year, starting September, they switched that around. And now, even though the milk is being packaged in New Jersey, it's coming from New York State. And so it's going to qualify and allow Long Island schools to possibly get to that 30% New York State bought level. So that was really exciting news this year. Of course, I'm not in the school to benefit from that and to make sure that that happens, but that was really great news that I was able to share with people this year. Were you involved in that at all?
We were not. I know the Department of Ag and Markets has been involved, and we were equally as elated to hear that news. We've worked closely with East End Farm to School on Long Island and have heard from them several years how important it is. And I think, you know, you're hitting on something. It has to do with supply chain. But when you get the right team together, the right partners to really have that mind, things can happen.
Yeah, it was really great. So how does American Farmland Trust's mission of saving the land that sustains us connect with what institutions are serving in the cafeteria?
It's a great question, and something where, you know, at times people are curious, well, why is American Farmland Trust working so closely with schools and other institutions? But there's just been so much momentum in recent years and really building off of decades of work in farm to institution and specifically farm to school that, you know, you see the benefit of purchasing and be able to have pathways for farmers to sell their products to schools and other institutions as a really great opportunity to support the farm business. And some of the research that we've done, you were mentioning the program that New York State has, there's a 30%, it's called 30% incentive, but essentially schools that are able to purchase 30% of their lunch budget from New York farms, they receive quadruple reimbursement for those lunch meals. And that's been a really big push for farmers and schools to think about how can we work together, because some of the research that we've done recently has identified that, you know, about 75% of the schools across the state think they're going to reach that 30% in the next 5 years, which has, you know, brings about $250 million in spending to farms that would not have happened before, and also, you know, the broader economy. So when we think about the opportunity for schools, there's certainly benefits around education, around connecting kids, you mentioned at the top of the conversation, how we're mentioning connecting children to how food is grown and even seeing that as a potential career for them. But our focus has really been around, this is a wonderful potential for farmers to think about their economic growth and making those local connections and keeping those connections within the state, certainly. But how are communities working alongside farmers to provide some of the best food I think we could have?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I know one, you know, while I was in the school, I actually was able to contract directly with a farmer to grow an extra 600 pounds of butternut squash for us. And so it was a field that they were not planning on planting because they didn't know if they needed it. Or, and by us contracting with them ahead of time, they planted a whole field for us, and it was just great. It was like our eggplant, you know, we could watch it grow. That was really, really nice. What are some of the barriers for schools and institutions in purchasing local?
Certainly there's training and staff. I know that, and I think we're thinking about this a lot now too, as a lot of places are understaffed, but it takes time and it takes expertise to take the butternut squash or the eggplant or whatever is being grown in the fields into a cafeteria and to be able to create recipes and to create meals for students. And so one of the big things that we've heard from schools is that, you know, having resources to have both, you know, staff capacity, but also the right training and support for their efforts around farm to school cost. And that's part of the reason too that the state program exists, to increase reimbursement for schools who are purchasing locally. Sometimes it does cost more to do that. And certainly that's a barrier that schools are thinking about, but I think remarkably many schools have worked to surpass, and certainly incentive is a way to do that. Supply chain, again, is something, and how to support more of those local connections. I think we're looking at how to increase the threshold of local procurement and some of the purchasing bids that could be barriers to schools because of the paperwork that's involved. How to make it a little bit easier for schools to purchase locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as someone who had to clean those 600 pounds of butternut squash, I really appreciate what you're saying. You know, I kept thinking, is there a machine that does this? You know, but I think also cafeteria people don't know what is out there actually that can make jobs easier. You know, I know using fresh greens. You know, if you don't have a good salad spinner, you know, forget it. You know, you can't serve wet salad, and some of those big industrial sized salad spinners just don't spin it enough to really get it dry. And if you don't get it dry, then it's just going to go bad quicker. So I think, you know, at least my experience is, and I know I'm speaking for myself, it could use a lesson in what is out there to make our jobs easier from the cafeteria side. You know, it's like, you know, you go online, you see people hooking up washing machines and using the spin cycle of a washing machine to spin their lettuce. And God, did I wish I had that, you know, but I didn't. I had this little plastic thing doing a little bit at a time. So I think, you know, lessons on what equipment is out there is what I have seen could really benefit a lot of the cafeterias in knowing how to process the food when you get it in its raw state from a farm. You know, it's a big difference than when you get it, you know, butternut squash already cubed at the supermarket. And yet any of us that have tried to buy butternut squash already cubed at the supermarket can tell when it's not fresh. I mean, it goes bad so quick. You know, it's just not the same as cutting your own fresh one. You know, it starts getting kind of slimy, and you don't want any of that in your soup. So I think, you know, equipment for processing is really essential. And does American Farmland Trust have any type of help? I know there's the whole program of farm to institution to help not just schools, but hospitals and jails and all these institutions purchase directly from farms as well. Is there a training set up for what kind of equipment to help process this and make it easier for the people in the cafeteria?
There's a few different pathways. So you mentioned American Farmland Trust helps coordinate Farm Institution New York State, and it's a statewide collaborative with the goal to increase purchases of New York grown and raised foods from all institutions. So we've been doing a lot of work, as we were discussing, with schools most recently, but really, you know, similar supply chains, similar, you know, farmers are not just selling to schools, they're selling beyond that. So how are we thinking more broadly? We have some resources that we provide online. We've been looking at what are some of the top grown products in New York State that might not have some of the information available about where do you purchase them and how do you process them and what are some recipes. So we have some New York grown food guides that we provide that are broadly available. We also have a specifically to schools, but how are we thinking about similar trainings, is a Farm to School Institute. So we're in our third or fourth year now of bringing schools together from across the state to hit on some of the things you addressed. Of how are schools setting a plan for their farm to school program, thinking about in, you know, the farm to school terms, the cafeteria, classroom, and community, where are those intervention points for students, and how to support their growth and progression to access and bring in more New York grown and raised foods by providing one-on-one coaching and even networking across the schools so that they're learning from each other, where we've got rural schools from various parts of the state, as well as, you know, New York City has been involved in the Institute since its inception. So I think being able to learn from each other, and if folks are using a washing machine or using a hand spinner. And then another thing too, because you mentioned this earlier as well, is that there are financial resources through grants available out there that AFT doesn't administer, but certainly like to promote and share, both from New York State and from U.S. Department of Agriculture. And in many cases, those are grants that help support staffing, but also support what is some of the equipment that's needed and what some of the training that's needed as well. So, you know, we kind of think about what are those combined resources that are available to schools as well as other institutions. And certainly, how do we also leverage what we're learning in one to start thinking about what are other institutions that are kind of poised for that type of intervention?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. The grant from New York State for my position, Farm to School, it didn't cover the cost of the food, right? It wasn't a grant that actually paid for the more expensive ingredients of fresh food, but it was to pay for more of the infrastructure to purchase equipment that would help you process that food. And that was, you know, where I felt like I personally could have really used a lesson. I mean, I've worked in restaurants, but again, restaurants are not doing bulk the way an institution is. You know, it's not, you know, you can hand spin lettuce for a couple salads in a restaurant, but you know, when you're feeding, you know, 6,000 kids, you know, in 45 minutes, you need something that works a little quicker than that. So it's just a different, you know, a different need. And so I think that's great that you do have the, you know, those resources available for the staffing, because it is definitely needed. So what is, you know, in American Farmlands Trust research, I know they've uncovered some of the issues that that are most challenging. Can you share those with us and what kind of solutions you've come up with?
Sure. I think, you know, schools are busy places. There's a lot, and something we've seen even more so in recent years. So one of the big challenges is certainly how to track what schools are bringing in terms of food. I mean, they're doing that as part of their food procurement anyways, but how to make it easier for schools to kind of reach the 30%, to reach the threshold that will increase their reimbursement, there's a lot of paperwork involved. So how to broaden that. Right now, the incentive program is only looking at lunch. So one solution that we've seen a pathway for, and certainly are looking to grow through the program, is to include breakfast and other national school lunch program meals. And just for ease of paperwork, but also kind of thinking about where is there opportunity. A lot of these schools are already buying New York apples and New York milk for breakfast. How do we make sure that that's both being counted towards their goal and also just easing the paperwork a little bit for those schools? So that's one piece. I think continuing to have pathways for staff support. There was this most recent farm to school grants that New York State had, where they were only able to award 50% of the applicants because there was so much demand. So how are we thinking about ways to continue to provide funding at the state level for schools to apply for, to be able to have those new tools and the education for staff and some of the staff support as well? So I'd say those are two of the big ones that are kind of most readily and available to address. There's certainly more intricacies around procurement regulations. I think I mentioned this earlier, is that how do we increase the threshold for small purchases where many of the local food access comes in, is through those smaller purchases. So how do we both reduce a little bit of the paperwork and make it a little bit more simpler for schools to bring in those products is something that we saw was important. And I think too, just, you know, how are we starting to think about the supply chain a bit more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So how's the pandemic affected all of this? You know, I know it's affected schools' ability to buy local and to do farm to school. Like I said, I'm no longer working at my school right now. You know, they just kind of put it on an indefinite hold. But meanwhile, I've had to find other work, and I don't know that I'll be available when they, when and if they ever say come back. So I know how it's affected me. How have you seen the pandemic affect these farm to school programs across the board?
I think part of it is yet to be known, as in many pieces of the pandemic now, but I think the biggest takeaway we've seen is that there's certainly this balance of passionate people who are working in schools and working as part of school teams who have been committed to sourcing locally and have started that pathway. And, you know, the pandemic has definitely shaken that up for schools, and they're seeing implications of reductions in budget, as well as concerns about staffing that I think are we're feeling beyond that. But schools are still really committed to that. So I think what our focus is how do we continue to provide support in ways that are responsive to where schools are, and identifying that you know, there is both a benefit to the health and education of students, and school teams recognize that, but also that there are definitely challenges to get there that we're going to be working on together. So I'd say, you know, we're seeing certainly challenges at the school level, a lot of support that's come in to support feeding programs at the federal and state level have been really important to keep those programs moving along. And so how are we continuing to support those schools in the process of, you know, reduced budgets, reduced staff, but by no means any dampering of interest and commitment to farm to school. I mean, we had a meeting a couple of weeks ago where several of our participants that, you know, think about our policy and think about our program and are working within the school system were, you know, one was making sandwiches for students while he was on the call, and others were kind of going around. And so you can see that the true commitment is there. But at the same time, you know, there are real challenges schools are facing.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read stories of, you know, people running out to Sam's Club and Costco to get food because what they ordered doesn't come in on the truck. Things are just backlogged so much. And I don't know if that's, you know, things that are, I don't know if it's as much in the local level or if it's just more of the national level where you're, you know, getting processed food that, you know, is not showing up, or whether it's the fresh, you know, local food. But the supply chain we've been hearing about across the board in everything, and food is no different as far as the supply chain goes. And I know I even was reading that they've had to relax a lot of the regulations and the standards of how much sugar or fat or, you know, those standards that are supposed to ensure that a school lunch meal is going to be healthy for these kids has been just thrown out the window, you know, and they just, you know, just need to feed the kids, and they don't really they're not worrying about meeting those regulations right now. Have you seen that?
Well, and I in hearing you speak about that too, of just where there have been kind of breaks in expectations of what's coming on the truck and what's not, it just really underscores how important it is to have some of those local relationships with farmers and to make it easier for schools to do that, because, you know, they're able to kind of be more responsive. At the same time, and I should add, because, you know, you certainly mentioned climate at the top of today's conversation, is, you know, these farmers are facing some of those issues. You know, maybe they're not facing the same distribution from their end in some cases, if you're doing direct relationships with farmers and schools or institutions, but we have to be mindful of what farmers are facing realistically. So I think schools in the pandemic, from the start of the pandemic, showed how nimble they could be in providing school lunches and other meals to students, even when they were not in school, and really feeding communities. And I think they're continuing to be nimble, and how important it is that they have enough staff and trained staff in order to do that. So when food comes off the truck and it's a little bit different than what was expected, that they can navigate that. Right. So I know most of my team would agree, or all my team would agree, is just like seeing how schools have been so responsive over the last couple of years and been able to make changes to feed students and feed students as healthy of meals as they can. And really seeing farm to school being a component of that has been incredible.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think the staff working in schools, and I would assume other institutions, you know, are really underappreciated. They work really hard to do the best that they can with the confinements, which are many, money being one of the biggest, supply, you know, getting product being, you know, that wasn't as much an issue when I was there, but I know it is now. So yeah, they're real heroes. They're doing a good job. You know, but as I know, you know, and most of my listeners have heard me talk so often about how for so many kids, this is the food that they, that's supporting them. That's, you know, that they don't go home to a full refrigerator like many kids in my area maybe do. They're really going home to a refrigerator with very little options, and the food that they eat at school is their main source of nutrition. And so, you know, I don't want to see them relax too much on that nutrition level, because the kids really need it. They really need it, you know, and, you know, that's the other thing that why I love the farm to school program so much, is because it's really teaching kids and introducing them more to vegetables, and they all need to eat more vegetables, you know, fruits and vegetables, but predominantly vegetables, because fruits are not such a hard sell. And, you know, the vegetables, I mean, there's so many kids that just turn their nose up at vegetables, but haven't really experienced fresh. I mean, that was my experience working in the school and bringing around samples like that butternut squash. You know, that was, you know, I made a little appetizer out of the butternut squash, and so, you know, and it was, for many, it was the first time they ever tasted butternut squash, and they were loving it. I also turned it into soup, because 600 pounds was a lot. I realized I overordered, so we also got some soup in addition. But, you know, they had never tried that. So I was really trying to cook up vegetables that were not your just broccoli or cauliflower, you know, but a little bit different. Asparagus I brought in, and, you know, different zucchinis, and, you know, really tried to mix it up a little bit for them. How does American Farmland Trust work on the state policy front to help schools and institutions? I know we touched on that a little bit, but can you talk a little bit about policy?
Sure. We help coordinate what's called the Alliance, the New York Grown Food for New York Kids Coalition. It is a group of educators and schools, cooperative extension teams that are helping to provide outreach, agricultural organizations, environmental, public health. You know, we kind of have this broad reach of organizations that see that shared benefit of farm to school programs and the support of that in New York State. So as part of that coalition, helped to kick off and move forward some of the programs that exist today, including the 30% reimbursement incentive that was introduced several years ago by the governor, and kind of really grew out of some of the historical work of members of that group, as well as some of the more immediate needs seen. We also work to advocate for the New York State Farm to School program to ensure that there are those resources that are out there, as well as learning and doing research to better understand what are some of those other pieces that are necessary to make the program, both of those programs, be more beneficial for schools and really to support farmers in the long run. So we help to organize that coalition. There are partners involved in that, but also anyone in New York State can join some of our advocacy efforts. We do several days that are virtual lobby days, where we can have individuals send emails, send notes, call legislators to put forth some of these and support some of these efforts that are really going to help schools to purchase more New York grown products. And so if anyone's interested, finesse.org, so it's finys.org. We have an email list, and that's where a lot of our efforts go out, as well as some of on our social media platforms.
Can you say that website again?
Finesse, finys.org. So it stands for Farm to Institution New York State.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, that was going to be my last question, are ways that people can get involved. Because I know a lot of my listeners, you know, and we didn't really have time to really touch on how farming is helping to mitigate climate change, and how, you know, American Farmland Trust is working with farmers to change their practices so that they are being part of the solution and not adding to the problem. But for my listeners who do want to get involved, besides, do you have a campaign going on right now where they can participate, or what is your suggestion there?
Right. So, you know, I think the website I mentioned was more specific to our farm institution work, but as you know, Pavina, we are doing work beyond that. So whether interested in our climate efforts, interested in farmland protection, thinking about connecting farmers to the land, I'd probably first direct folks to farmland.org/New York, which is where you can learn more about our New York programs and sign up for our email. And that's a great way to get involved. We're also on social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So if you're involved in any of those ways, we have Farmland New York, American Farmland Trust New York versions of all of those. So I'm happy to share those for your listeners here, but also to make sure that they're on the website too.
Uh-huh. And last question is New York State doing anything to help farmers? I know you talked about how many farmers are already 65 or plus and are ready for retirement. How do we get farmers to keep their farmland farming as opposed to selling out to developers? Because so often we hear about that they can make more money selling to a developer, especially after the pandemic. Now all the property outside of New York, since everyone can work remotely, the prices are just going up for land. How do we keep that affordable for people to farm?
That's a great question. And I feel like a whole other topic for a whole other day, but
I know yeah, you have two minutes to answer that.
well, let's see. But I think there are definitely programs that New York State has that, protecting farmland is a really great one because it helps to keep the farmland farming, or in agriculture, but there are also tools that keep that more affordable that New York State has, and we want to continue to grow. Certainly, we have a program, I mentioned it earlier, Farmland for New Generation New York, nyfarmlandfinder.org, where farmers are able to match. So I think, how do we support farmers to find each other? That's one step to do it, because it can be really daunting to go through that process, especially if you're a new farmer, not coming from a farm family, able to try and find an access land. There are tools that New York State has, that federal government has, that local communities have, but it's a lot to figure out. So how to support farmers to navigate some of that program is really devoted to that piece. And we should definitely talk about another day.
Okay.
Bhavani, and I really appreciate the time today to talk about farm to school too.
Wonderful. Thank you, Erica, so much for joining me. It's been so informative, and I just love the work you're doing. So thank you. And everybody out there who's been joining us today, thank you so much for joining us. Again, you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.